Donna Kitchen talks about food. Donna Kitchen talks recipes. Donna Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donna Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctical.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We're here in the KHOI community radio station. We're here at the kitchen table. We talk about food, farming, advice.
Farming politics.
Opinions. Oh, we do
agronomy.
Have opinions. Recipes. We do all sorts of stuff here. Thanks for joining us here on this fine radio station. We get by with a little help from our friends.
Support comes from Wheatsfield Co-op, your full-service natural foods grocer in Ames, community-owned, community-focused since 1974, open daily 7 a.m. to 9 p.m., located downtown at 413 Northwestern, just off Main Street in Ames. Everyone can shop Wheatsfield Co-op.
And we do. This is the Donna Kitchen. Welcome. Get yourself a cup of coffee and have a good listen around our kitchen table. There's lots going on outside the window of our
spring
kitchen
here. Spring
is sprung, hopefully. Spring is sprung, and birds are starting to do this stuff outside that they're not doing. There are noises we don't hear because the birds are kind of peeping and doing things. Robins are flitting around looking alternately cold and hungry. But it's coming. It's coming. Spring is coming. And I have a bird sighting outside my kitchen window to report. I saw one of these maybe 20
years ago.
It's nice
to know that it's heavily wooded and slightly out in the country where Lana lives, because I haven't seen anything like this in my backyard in Ames.
Believe it or not, a pileated woodpecker has come to my
woods. I love that name.
Woods.
Pileated.
Or is it called pileated? I call it a pileated woodpecker. This is a big honker woodpecker, folks. We normally have things like, downy woodpeckers and red-bellied woodpeckers. Very rarely a red-headed woodpecker anymore. But there are little birds that peck at things, and we call them woodpeckers. This one is like really big, really big. Let's see, about 16 and a half inches long, wingspan 29 inches wide.
Huh?
It's pretty big. And it's very black
on the
back.
This is like Woody Woodpecker kind of guy.
It's got one of those amazing red pointy crests on its head. An amazing thing. And it hung around long enough that, yes, that's what it was. I was able to get the binoculars out and look at these things.
Did you hear it? Does it have a call?
It does, and I've been hearing this, not the call so much,
The knocking.
And reading in my Sibley Field Guide to the Birds, it's got a nice picture of it here, too. It says that it favors carpenter ants, so it often forages low on the dead trees or on fallen logs. And I noticed this thing. I've been hearing this. The bang, 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 or the peck, peck, peck that you hear, it's very loud, but it's only very short. Peck, 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 peck. And then it's really quiet for a while. Peck, 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 peck. Then really quiet for a while. And that's because the bird, and I saw the bird do this, was working its way down the tree backwards. And it likes to feed way down the tree as opposed to way up in the tree. And I was seeing it down on the ground. I thought, you don't want to go down there. You know, heaven knows you're going to get picked off. But it's an awfully big bird. So that's what it says here in the bird book, that it works its way down the tree and likes to feed on little ants coming up the tree from the bottom. So anybody else see a pileated or a pileated woodpecker? They're out there. There is one, anyway. And I have seen one, like, I'd say 20 years ago, whatever, ages ago. When I first moved to the country, I saw one of these. And there it is again. Ah, spring in Ames.
Well, that's quite remarkable. So a couple of weeks ago, David Orr was speaking in the Great Hall on campus for a sustainability conference. And he is sort of the grand gentleman of education and environmental programs, really. He's from Oberlin College. He has a lot of different – his early book was Earth and Mind. It's a seminal text in environmental studies for classrooms around the country. His new book, his eighth book called Dangerous Years, Climate Change and the Long Emergency, will be published by Yale University Press this year. But David was in Ames talking about the community work that they have done in the Ohio town of Oberlin, which is it's a small town with a small but very lovely college. I actually started college there many, many years ago. But he describes it as a Rust Belt town, which it is. It's fairly near Cleveland and has a lot of the problems that, you know, small towns like that have. And he talked about the things that they had developed as a community in terms of energy and education and resources and the buildings. They've built a couple and there are standards and stars and stuff for this kind of architecture, which is completely, you know,
sustainable.
Yes, right. It produces all of its own energy. It deals with all of its water and septic. They use these interesting. He didn't show pictures of it, but they said, yeah, sure, the water fountains, we understand, but what are we going to do, put the toilets in the next building? No, they have systems within the building that clean the sewage through, I think it's part of probably a John Todd living machines system is what I'm guessing. I don't know.
Plants and wetlands.
Within the buildings.
There are natural ways to clean this stuff. Anyway, using all the bright minds of our colleges and bright minds. There's people around here that can figure this out.
Yeah, and
architects and planners.
Oh, and there are plenty. Yeah. They use the work of William McDonough, but he was also referring to Jane Jacobs' work, who's an urban planner. I guess that would be the right title, but she's talked a lot about community and development for a long time. And I think he was kind of touring around urging, you know, communities like Ames to. His main message was, you know, it's not going to happen from the top down. Don't wait for the federal government to arrive or even the state government to arrive and help your community, you know, be clean and well-funded. And he talked about keeping the money locally and all the things that, especially here on the radio, you know, we've got a local radio station. Mm-hmm. So we've got – that's a linchpin in keeping the community informed. So it was a lovely, lovely conversation.
And one of the things that I really enjoyed from his talk is the fact that doing things locally, doing things sustainably is the only way we are going to be able to deal at all with climate change, keep carbon in the ground, be able to feed ourselves, heat ourselves, live. We have to learn how to do it more sustainably. The earth is not
one little town at a time.
The earth is not an infinite resource. The only it even works out bottom line. It even works out.
Right, he was saying
money wise,
right?
Folks.
It's the economically most viable solution. I have a lovely quote from this, and this is from his book Earth in Mind. Quote from David Orr, the plain fact is that the planet does not need more successful people, but it does desperately need more peacemakers, healers, restorers, storytellers, and lovers of every kind. It needs people who live well in their places. It needs people of moral courage, willing to join the fight to make the world habitable and humane. And these qualities have little to do with success as we have defined it. That's David Orr, and he's talking to us, Ames.
Yes, David Orr, and his book is called Dangerous Years, Climate Change in the Long Emergency.
Right. That'll be out this summer.
We're thinking about also things that affect us. This burning of fossil fuels and the fact that so much of our planet is being dug up, burned, it is affecting us, folks, and a lot of us realize that we can't do things the same old way, except the same old way is trying to march its way across Iowa because the Bakken oil fields have wanted to ship their product in a pipeline
Right under us.
Right under us, right under, through a whole lot of counties, under a whole lot of farmland.
And definitely, right. They went to put a pumping station in Ames.
Right. And there's issues of eminent domain. There's issues of water quality. There's issues of liability for all of this stuff going on. How much longer are we going to be doing all of this mining of our fossil fuels? Change will come. Change will come. We have mentioned before a book that has just been published called Fracture and edited by Taylor Broby and Stephanie Brooke Trout. It's from some people right here in Ames.
From the
Ice Cube Press. And it's a lovely collection of essays, poems, people's opinions, and people's reality of how they are dealing with this thing called fracking and how it affects not just Iowa, not just North Dakota. It's happening all over the country, all over the world. And these are stories of what this is like. We have gotten a permission to read a little bit of it. Donna, tell them about this lovely short story.
Well, we're going to read this because very quickly, the Iowa Utility Board is going to announce whether they are going to allow the pipeline or not. Now, this is a fairly momentous decision for us, and it's coming out, I think, within this coming week. So this piece I'm reading is it's called Seduction. It's a little fiction piece by Mary Heather Noble. And I think it's a very charming explanation for how we get suckered into all of this. So this is called Seduction. It's a bit like adolescence, all this newfound attention that you think you understand, and the young man sitting on your mother's flowered couch is polite and respectful in a way that she'd sworn had gone extinct, talking about your future and security and the wealth of opportunities to come. And though you barely even know him, you can't but feel a little bit taken with his outsider accent, his pressed polo shirt, and the company logo over his heart. The way he folds his long fingers around your mother's chipped coffee mug as the steam from the brew rises and dances around his lips, which keep moving and assuring you that it will be safe. And think of the potential of this place. He uses noble words like exploration and independence and speaks of recovery in a way that means returning to normal or a healthy state of being, as if the way that you've been living here is neither of these things. He speaks of recovery as in returning something to its rightful owner, which is you and your family. Of course, you want what's yours. You'll remember those moving lips when the trucks come rumbling in hour after hour, again and again, and the midnight light from the drill pad trespasses through your drawn bedroom curtains, and the clanging and pounding invading the silence of your room. You'll remember those promises as you try to ignore the chemical veil and swallow the anxiety of what could be seeping into your well. Of course you want what's yours. But you won't know that what they're taking from when you unlock the gate and let them in, forcing and drilling and injecting God knows what into God knows where, and you'll think you're doing this for your future. Think you're doing this out of love. But what do you know of love except for your mother's palm olive hands and the dance of the willows before a storm, a clean glass of water, the crescendo of cicada in the afternoons, the smell of wildflower dew. You'll be fooled by the softness of what they promise in the beginning and the finesse, but shocked by the unexpected violence of a frack. There's a persistent sting to innocence lost, a trace of diesel in the air. So that's from Fracture, Essays, Poems, and Stories on Fracking in America. So we'll see what the Iowa Utility Board unfolds for us here in Iowa very shortly.
We shall see. You are listening to KHOI 89.1. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen, Tasty Radio for the Heart of Iowa. Thank you. We're back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We've been considering some kind of heavy topics here outside of our kitchen window. The environment has a lot to do with us. Guess what? We are part of it. How we deal with the earth has a lot to do with how we exist and how we deal with each other. Let's consider another little bit of
some levity, perhaps.
Some levity, yeah. But like Donna says, okay, we have bummer news here every now and then.
A little too frequently, unfortunately.
We try to deal with reality here. And we were dealing with the book Fracture, which is a lovely collection of essays and poems and whatever. I grew up with a storybook. I grew up with a lot of storybooks, but I pulled one off my shelf, and I brought it in, and Donna said,
We actually both have our original copies. It's kind of amazing. It's one of the few, I mean, maybe I have five books from my childhood that I have then read to my grandchildren and my children all the way through. And Lana opened up this poem.
Right. Probably a lot of you had this storybook stuck away someplace. It's called the Better Homes and Gardens Storybook.
And there were two volumes, a yellow one and an orange one. We've got the yellow one here.
I think I kind of read this today. Published by Meredith Publishing Company in Des Moines. Copyright, mine is copyright 1950. And this was a big part of my childhood. But
me too.
I remember this poem because it's the kind of poem that I think I memorized. I could always taunt my brother with this poem. It was nice.
I loved it, too.
It's something that we don't talk about in a formal sort of setting, but it would be awfully bad if we didn't have some sort of rules and regulations as to our manners with one another.
Table manners.
This is about table manners. It is a poem. Let's see. Copyright 1900.
Mm-hmm.
Written by Gelett Burgess, or is that Gillette? G-E-L-E-T-T. Burgess.
Don't know. That's an old-fashioned name, I think.
Probably even the copyright has run out of this, but the copyright of 1900 is on this. And the poem, there's two poems here, Table Manners 1 and Table Manners 2. So think about this as you are sipping your soup and slurping your crumbs, and anyway, one must always remember that sitting around a table, other people are watching us. So behave yourselves out there. It's called The Goops. Table Manners 1. The goops, they lick their fingers. The goops, they lick their knives. They spill their broth on the tablecloth. Oh, they lead disgusting lives. The goops, they talk while eating. Loud and fast they chew. And that is why I am glad that I'm not a goop. Are you? Table Manners 2. The goops are gluttonous and rude. They gug and gumble with their food. They throw their crumbs upon the floor, and at dessert they tease for more. They will not eat their soup and bread, but like to gobble sweets instead. And that is why I oft decline when I am asked to stay and dine. There.
Yes, and I think that's a good indication of the way both Lana and I and a lot of us were raised. The goops.
Yeah, I do remember being able to taunt my brother with his man. He was younger than I was, so he dribbled a bit more there for a while. And yeah, one remembers these things. Isn't it wonderful when you find an old storybook and there's a lot of good memories? Yes, there are.
Well, the one thing that always happened at our table was invariably, and probably mostly me, we would spill the milk. And
yes,
my mother would be furious because it would make a... And then one time for Christmas, somebody gave her a pitcher, right? And on it was that saying, "Don't cry over spilt milk," right?
How perfect!
Yeah,
how perfect! Yes. Oh, yeah. I remember just the always having an extra towel ready to put under where you spilt. Yeah, because that did happen. I don't know. Maybe you and I were born way before the invention of the tippy cup. I don't remember.
We didn't have tippy cups.
We were expected to have table manners, and one learns eventually. So there we have it. The goops. Table Manners 1 and Table Manners 2. So, what else do you have for us, Donna?
Well, I've been sort of, you know, doing my usual food reading on the internet and otherwise, and I found a new product that's coming. You can't actually even buy it yet, but there's been a bit of food press about it, and it's being called coffee flour. It's not really a flour, and they're describing it. I'm reading from coffeeflour.com. This must be one of the companies that's...
Oh, flour as in flour like for bread.
Yeah,
F-L-O-U-R. Like
okay. No, it's actually from the fruit of the coffee bean. So it says, this is an agricultural innovation with the potential to do some really good things for the world. And we just don't mean the food world. Each year, billions of coffee beans that eventually make their way into the Americanos, lattes, and the no foams, the extra hots, the triple shot cappuccinos of the world are harvested by milling and extracting them from the coffee plant. So the part that's the bean that we know is the seed, but around the bean is the fruit.
Oh!
The fruit of the coffee, and it's often discarded and it's dumped into rivers and left to rot in heaps. So what this company and probably a few others, they are inventing something better to do with the fruit. It says, for farmers and families in coffee-growing countries, it will create sustainable jobs and a new revenue source for some of the poorest areas of the world. For the environment, it will remove botanical waste from streams and soils, strengthening the land and the lives of the people and species there. And for the rest of us, it will add a nutritious and distinctly flavorful ingredient to the global menu. So what they're saying is different people have been writing about the flavor of this. It's not technically a flour, but they've been using it mostly to put into baked goods because it has various fruit flavors. It's apparently very high in protein. Of course, it's very high in antioxidants. And it has different flavors depending on the variety of the bean and where it was grown. So this site, coffeeflour.com, has something called Whole Coffee News. Coffee flour global community is growing every day from celebrity chefs and food companies. So,
well, good.
I think the interesting part of the story is there's being made in the culinary world more and more examination of the waste products and how to use them so that they become a benefit rather than a detriment in the system. And this is a very good story and example of that. I'm looking forward to the coffee flour, F-L-O-U-R. And as soon as it comes on the market, we'll give it a try. We're going to talk about...
And Easter. Eventually, Easter is coming up at the end of this month. So there's egg.
Yeah,
egg ideas.
I read a new method of cooking eggs, which I have not tried yet. But I want to pass this on. And if you guys try it, let us know. I'm going to do it this year for the Easter egg hunt. It's another way to get hard-boiled eggs. Instead of doing them on the stovetop, they recommend roasting them.
Roasting eggs.
Yes, listen to this. It says, how do I make eggs in the oven? You just preheat to 325 degrees or 350 if your oven runs a little cooler. And you place the eggs in the mini muffin tins.
Oh, yeah, so they don't roll around.
Right, exactly. And then you cook them for 30 minutes at 325. And then you place them in cool water afterwards for about 10 minutes. It says, baked eggs will have a slightly creamier texture than boiled ones.
I wonder why.
Well, if you just think of something, the difference between stove cup, well, maybe because the heating is even more and slower. I mean, after all, you have to do it for 30 minutes.
Okay.
So it's probably slower.
And also, they're not immersed in water. Egg shells are permeable.
Oven baking is the easiest way to make eggs in bulk. Think about the Easter bunny.
Oh, eggs.
They'll cook to perfection consistently with almost no effort. Plus, you can keep your hard-baked eggs in the fridge for up to a week.
Putting them in a muffin tin sounds like a...
In the preheated oven.
Preheated oven, okay.
So it would have the heat evenly around it. And this is from a website called purewow.com, so I can give them the credit for it.
But Pure Wow.
Remember, 325, put them, and you can probably do a large amount, depending if you have enough muffin tins, for 30 minutes, and then place them in cool. cool water.
Cold.
Uh-huh. Cool water for 10 minutes. There you go.
Oh, I want to mention one place that I have been. Oh, took a road trip. And I want to recommend stopping at this place. If you are ever in Winterset, Iowa, there's a place called the Northside Cafe. Amazing place. And what they're doing a fine job of is feeding Iowans very recognizable
Iowa food,
but done with really good Iowa ingredients. I always like to go, if I'm going to sit down in a diner, give me a hamburger. What in the world do you, I want to see what they do.
I want a good hamburger.
And it was a lovely hamburger and probably the best hamburger bun I've ever had. It was absolutely delicious. It was all flaky, or not flaky, it was all speckledy with whole wheat stuff and crunchy bits in it. Mm. It was very good. Mm-hmm. And the menu also, when you sit down, when you first look at it, it looks like a regular menu, but besides the usual blue plate specials and the hamburger and the chicken fried steak and all that kind of stuff, you can also get things like crab cakes and baked chèvre. And as a matter of course, you can get wilted kale salad or a very nice kale pasta dish. So it's got something for everybody, and pies. They do pies. Good job, Northside Cafe in Winterset, Iowa. The Donna Lana Kitchen. Welcome back. You are listening to KHOI 89.1 FM, Story City and Ames. Oh, I ran across a really interesting item in the newspaper. It has to do with two of our food icons. They're in a little trouble. I'm referring to the Pillsbury Doughboy and Betty Crocker. They have been part of our kitchens for a long time. The General Mills, Betty Crocker, and the Pillsbury Company were pioneers in improving
processed food.
in processed food, which freed our mothers and grandmothers from all of that.
Or so they promised.
So for years and years, they produced all of these boxed mixes and pre-baked or half-baked things and cake mixes and frozen doughs and things, frozen cookie dough, all the stuff that people still always like to have fresh cookies and cakes and all that kind of thing. And for years and years, we baked by just buying a box, and the box would say on the back of it sometimes.
Add two eggs and a cup of water or something like that, right?
And boy, that made things, actually maybe that's good. It made things accessible for people that wanted a cake and
My quarrel with cake mixes was always really all it is flour, baking soda, and some flavors, which you can readily do yourself.
There really isn't much in that box, but the fact the fact that they spent their time making these boxes, and they put pictures on the cover.
I don't know. I would claim that that disempowered people.
Well,
it made them think they couldn't just, like, open up the Joy of Cooking. And
back when I was just starting college, I learned to cook by finding one of those boxes, and it had a picture of the thing. And on the back, you looked and had step one, step two, step three.
Oh, I started out at about 10 years old with my Betty Crocker cookbook.
Different way to do it.
But that did have recipes in it. Now, on the other hand, the packaged things that were yeasted, that was a little more complex.
Mm-hmm.
We did use those in the biscuits and cinnamon rolls were a particular favorite of my father. Even a few years ago, my daughter was cranking those out, much to his delight.
And the fact that we could see on television these things, well, like the Pillsbury Doughboy. What a nice little guy. They were part of our visual heritage, pictures of things coming out of the oven, like nothing says loving like something from
the
oven.
Right.
And,
that's right. And that's true.
And
still
of course,
true.
We always remember that amazing technological advance when we could see that roll of crescent rolls in a tube, and you'd hit that on the corner of the counter, and it poofed. And wow, I mean, physics in the kitchen. This
it's still, I have to say, kind of thrilling. I mean, I don't eat that stuff because I'm a little concerned about the qualities of the oils, and I also try not to eat a lot of white processed flours. But it's pretty yummy.
Lately, General Mills and Pillsbury have been having quite a slump in all of this prepackaged cake mixes and pie mixes and bread and dough mixes and even the frozen bread doughs.
Really? They're not selling as well.
They're just not selling very well. It says here that the cause lies partly in American consumer dietary habits that are changing. And
less carbohydrates,
also,
do you think?
Yeah. A larger there's a stagnation in the entire U.S. packaged food industry. Consumers are more and more turning away from the center aisles of grocery stores and buying. Well, we encourage people to do that. Also,
yeah, we've encouraged them, and it's working.
Yeah, people are making better food choices. But here's another one. Maybe a big factor is the category that people are just too busy. There's a whole lot of us that are just plain eating out a whole lot more. So nobody has time to even take the magic of the
shortcut, even.
The magic of frozen dough or the magic of those tubes with
the refrigerator.
Yeah, we don't even take time to poke the Pillsbury Doughboy in the belly anymore.
Oh, so, goodness.
So this article was in, like, it was in the Ames Tribune. Where do I find any other good articles? The fact that refrigerated dough sales are down, and packaged cake mixes are down, losing all kinds of business for General Mills and for Pillsbury.
Oh, I mean, are we going to feel sorry for the processed food makers?
They'll figure out.
Don't worry, they'll
something.
Figure out how to sell it
they'll
to the restaurants, and we'll eat it anyway, right?
And surprisingly, this was in the same day in the paper that I ran across the big news about the black hole discovery, the fact that gravitational waves existing in space-time were discovered. I thought, well, maybe that has something to do with the fact that we are not baking anymore. There's gravitational waves pulling the interest right out of the kitchen. Who knows? It's all connected. Einstein was right. Gravitational waves do exist. I don't know what exactly that has to do with our cooking and our baking. But one thing about the processed food giants, the big corporations that are doing that, they are connecting to more of us through the internet. There's the Betty Crocker website, and there's this General Mills website, and more of us are talking to each other and learning about food that way. That is doing fine for those companies. Unfortunately, it's not making them a whole lot of money when people
no,
are going.
No, it's free.
It's free. But yeah, all those sales have been going down for them. So think about your boxed cake mixes. Take Donna's advice. If you want to look at a boxed cake mix and get a picture of what it looks like, that's fine. But folks, it really isn't all that hard. You can do this.
No,
you can,
especially the kind of cake that you would make from a box cake,
right,
which is just either a sheet cake or a couple of little round pans to get the layers. Those recipes are pretty simple. I mean, even in The Joy of Cooking, there's a, what's it called, a one-bowl quick cake recipe where you actually throw the eggs, the flour, the, I think it's melted butter, you know, in, use the handheld mixer, and boom, off you go.
It is. So these big companies have made lots of money over the years selling us the dry stuff
at a greater expense than if we just took the flour out of the jar at home.
There you go. There you go. So get to it, folks. Oh, this brings up a idea from my mom's recipe box, and this got made a lot at home. Mom had a recipe called lightning cake.
Yes. That's a quick cake.
That's exactly what it is. And the recipe really, she said, this is one of the first things I learned to bake. She said when the home ec class is where I learned it.
Yeah.
And as she said, when the threshing crew, when the men would come in from the barn, they expected a cake from when they came in out
or
of the
pie.
Or a pie. And this was a quick cake, and her recipe still has that lightning cake recipe, still has the measurements, as in, take a coffee cup, break an egg into it, fill a coffee cup up to the top with milk. That's your liquid. And then on from there. But it was a quick cake. We can do this. Learn how to bake by yourself. It's a lot of fun in the kitchen.
And if you're going to bake, you can use like a whole wheat pastry flour.
Very good.
Which will up the nutrition considerably.
And the pastry flour does make a difference. You don't want to use...
Don't use whole wheat bread flour.
Don't use bread flour. It's a whole different animal.
It's a different wheat. The bread flour is a hard winter wheat and will not make good cakes. And the pastry flour is a soft white wheat.
There you go. Oh, I'm hungry. I may just go home and get out that lightning cake recipe. Is that what it was called in your home ec class, lightning cake?
It's quick cake.
Quick cake, yeah.
It's the same thing, lightning cake. It means fast and easy.
Fast and easy. One of those things that's good to know. Good. All right. You're listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. This is community radio. To find out more about the Donna Lana Kitchen, go to khoifm.org. You'll find the web page there. And while you are there, there's a button on that page called Donate. Poke that button. This is community radio. This is mainly all put together by volunteers. Donna and I are volunteers. We just get on here and talk about what we like. And a lot of the other voices that you hear on this radio station do the same thing. Support this radio station. We talk to your ears. And we'd also love to hear from you. You can email us at khoiradio@gmail.com. What's on your plate? Send us a recipe. Yes, do that. Do that. Donna has a few things to say about how to take culinary advice with a grain of salt. Take it away, Donna.
Well, I had a piece that I wrote for a cookbook, I don't know, golly, more than 10 years ago. And I called it The Tyranny of the Recipe. And really, I wrote it as an introduction to the recipes that I was writing in the book. And partially I did that because when I write a recipe, I try not to make it so precise that you have to have this ingredient and run out to the store and buy it if you don't have it. And I think as I write recipes, I personally want the recipe to be a kind of a loose-knit structure that encourages one to explore and taste and rely upon one's own judgment. And this was written, you know, more than 10 years ago. And I think it's only intensified, like, because people watch a lot of food television and, you know, somehow a lot of cookbooks have become what I call food porn, which means they set impossible standards. They have beautiful pictures and really, in some senses, even though they're most meant to be encouraging. I think what they do sometimes is they discourage one about one's own ability and one's own creativity. It's much in the way of if somebody is watching too much porn, they start to denigrate the reality of the body that they have and the people around them. You know, it's like some kind of impossible standard. So what I want to do is, you know, I'll read just a little bit of this, but I wrote, recipes are useful guidelines, especially if family culinary traditions have been obscured by a recent generation or two that didn't really enjoy hanging out in the kitchen, eating, and blessing together. But to really understand, enjoy cooking and food, forget about being a slave to the recipe. So basically, recipes are cooking methodologies founded like a map, kind of, or a treasure hunt or something. You still have to find your own way. And I think a good recipe will either tell you something about maybe the cultural traditions and heritage of something, or even maybe basic nutrition and how to handle certain produce or provenance or something like that.
I find the best cookbooks have got the stories about them.
Yes, exactly.
And even when you get a recipe from a friend, the story behind the food is often the best part. That's what makes you hungry.
Yeah, and I think historically, first of all, recipes have only really been written down predominantly. Well, there were some maybe 1850s cookbooks, but more, it's really more a 20th century invention. You know, our foremothers and fathers, our ancestral mothers, cooked agriculturally, kind of based on geography, weather patterns, where they came from, the communities they lived in. And there were no food fashions. People cooked consistently, mostly the same kinds of things for hundreds and hundreds of years and many, many generations. So you really learn from it. It was passed down as an oral tradition, much like any other craft. You kind of watched and learned, and the main thing is tasting. You know, I'm what I call a tasting cook. I see these people who turn out food and they haven't tasted the whole thing. They're just kind of following the list of things. So when I'm cooking, I keep a whole pile of spoons next to me to dip in and take a taste at almost every step of the way. My most basic instruction really is to taste as you go along. If the flavor pleases you, it will taste good to other people. I often get asked, I think this is the most frequent question, is how long should I cook it? And I go, my answer is, cook it till it's done.
That's true.
Well, because even in a, you know, a very formal recipe, when they set up they'll give you a temperature and they'll give you a time. However, there are so many variables. First of all, hardly anyone's oven is really the temperature that it says it is. And also, you know, things like humidity and weather and moisture content and, you know, air pressure. All of these are variables. So I noticed one thing. When I'm cooking, just before something starts to be done, especially if it's in the oven, but not just in the oven, there's a smell that comes out of it. And you know that smell because all of a sudden you go, oh, it's starting to smell like you think it's supposed to.
Or, oh, did I forget it? Or did I? Well, maybe I better look.
No, that's,
that's too far.
When it's
too
late,
okay.
Right? When it first starts to smell really good is when it's very close to being done. And that's when you kind of need to start watching. Like a professional chef can, like for cooking meat, you can, or fish even, you can press on the meat or the fish with your thumb and know by the feel of it, just if it's medium rare or if it's at the right, you know, or sometimes just poking a fork in it, how easily does the fork go in? You know, these are tactile things that I would encourage you to do. Taste it, feel it, poke it.
Look at it, you know, all of that
kind of thing. What I do, the only cookbook I really, really recommend is, of course, The Joy of Cooking. I think it has every basic thing that most Americans would really, really want. And they give you kind of a good starting point, you know. And then one thing I often do in any recipe that I'm reading that's printed is I will up the herb and spice content. Not the salt, and there are only a few herbs that you can have too much of. Like you can use too much rosemary, for example. What else can you use too much of that you could really overdose on? Not very many things.
Cayenne pepper.
Oh, yes, that's a very individual thing. The heat of a dish is pretty.
Yes, this idea of trusting your senses. After all, the whole idea of this is to feed ourselves. I don't think we have lost the ability to know what's good for us, even though we may be really out of practice.
Well, and it's also cooking is a very creative process. So if you're using your own sensory apparatus, your smeller and your taster, to kind of make a creation, you own it. It's kind of like painting, I think, in some senses, only it disappears immediately and it doesn't have to go in a frame on the wall. But it's like you're saying, this is my taste. And that word taste has many meanings other than the literal, but this is so literal. And I think it's more of a pleasure if you're cooking it the way you want to. And you can enjoy that and you can offer it to your friends and your family with your own confidence and your own pleasure in the cooking, you know. So it's not a tedious thing.
And don't be set back by what you consider mistakes. If things don't taste right,
keep going.
Keep going. Learn. Say, oh, just do it a little different next time. And, yes, the food – I often think vegetables talk to you. I understand it does that when – they're growing, for one thing. Are vegetables happy? Are they in the right place? Do they have enough water? But also, as they're cooking, you can watch them. You can taste them. Is this right? Are they ready? Yeah, sure.
Well, and another thing, you know, if something doesn't taste quite the way you expected to, it may not be that you've underdone it, overdone it. You may have underdone it. Sometimes you need to add more of this, that, and the other. One thing I do as I'm kind of, you know, if I'm experimenting, I will have some little dishes, and I'll take a couple spoonfuls of something and put it in a separate dish and go, okay, now what would happen if, say, I added more mint or if I added more of this? And I'll put a little bit into a sample dish and see if I like that flavor before I take on the whole pot of it.
Oh, that's a good idea, instead of just throwing it right in the pot.
Yeah, because if you've oopsed, you haven't oopsed the whole dish. You know, you can have a little sample. It's rather like if you're going to paint a new color on the wall, you paint a sample piece to see, oh, can I live with that color? You know, so you can do little tastings along the way. I often use saucers and little monkey dishes, they're called, for that sort of thing. But the most important thing is to develop your own confidence and your own set of taste buds that please you. You.
You have been listening to the Donalana Kitchen. We've been talking about all kinds of those wonderful little subjects that sort of pile up on your kitchen counter, and we're glad we got around to them today. We talked about our responsibility to the environment. We talked about things like fracking and things that are going on outside of our kitchen window.
And cake baking.
Why not? We talked about that too. And Donna mentioned things like coffee, flour, and eggs that you can bake, hard-boiled eggs that you can bake in the oven. You learn all kinds of new things on this radio show. Yes, you do. My name's Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintos.
If you can't get enough of us on Tuesday at noon at KHOI, you can listen again Tuesday in the evening at 7 p.m. or anytime on KHOIFM.org. Support this fine radio station. We've had excellent engineering by Rick Morrison. Eat good food and enjoy life.